Sarva Shastra Abdi Piyusha Sarva Vedaika Satpala Sarva Siddhanta Ratnadya Sarva Lokaika Drikpada Sarva Bhagavata Prana Srimad Bhagavata Prabhu Alidvanta Uditaditya Shri Krishna Parivartita Paramananda Partaya Prema Varshakshadayati Sarvada Sarva Sevyaya Shri Krishnaya Namostume Marekubanda Matsangin Madguru Madmahadana Mangistadaka Madvagya Madananda Namostute Asadu Saduta Dayin Atinicho Chatakara Hama Muncha Padachin Mam Tvimnarit Kantayok Spura Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Purvasya Dauparardasya. Brahmo nama mahanabhut Kalpo yatra bhavad brahma
Shabda brahmeti yam viduhu
Purvasya dao parardasya Brahmo nama mahanabhut Kalpo yatra bhavad brahma Shabda brahmeti yam viduhu Purvasya of the first half. Adau,
in the beginning.
Para ardhasya, of the superior half. Brahmaha, Brahmakalpa. Nama, of the name. Mahan, very great. Abhut, was manifest. Kalpaha, millennium. Yatra, whereupon. Abhavat,
appeared.
Brahma, Lord Brahma. Shabda Brahma iti. The sounds of the Vedas. Yam, which. Viduhu, they know. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. In the beginning of the first half of Brahma's life, there was a millennium called Brahmakalpa, wherein Lord Brahma appeared. The birth of the Vedas was simultaneous with Brahma's birth. Purport. According to Padma Purana Prabhasa Kunda, in 30 days of Brahma many kalpas take place, such as the Varaha Kalpa and Pitri Kalpa. 30 days make 1 month of Brahma, beginning from the full moon in the disappearance, to the disappearance of the moon. 12 such months complete 1 year, and 50 years complete one parardha, or one half the duration of the life of Brahma. The Shweta Varaha appearance of the Lord is the first birthday of Brahma. The birthday of Brahma is the month of March, in the month of March, according to Hindu astronomical calculation. This statement is reproduced from the explanation of Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura. So calculations can be made of the measurement of Lord Brahma's life, of his months and years and days. It says here the birth of the Vedas was simultaneous with Brahma's birth Why is that mentioned here? Shabda Brahmeti. It's called Brahma Kalpa, maybe because it's the day in which Brahma was born. But the term here is introduced also Shabda Brahma. So Brahman also refers to the Vedas. The living entity who took birth as Brahma is eternal. He wasn't actually born at that time. He was put into that body at that time. The Vedas are also co-eternal with God. They were never written. Therefore, they exist eternally. They exist in Vaikuntha. And everything in Vaikuntha has no beginning and no end. It's eternal. So the appearance of the Vedas in the material world is just that. It's not their creation, it's their appearance in a certain place. If I take a trip to Madras, maybe people haven't seen me there before. Not that there's any use for them to see me there, but that's not my birth. I wasn't born in Madras. I stepped out of the train in Madras. So the Vedas appear at the beginning of creation from the mouths of Brahma. That's not the beginning of the Vedas, and it's not the beginning of all the Jivas either, when they come out of the glance of Mahavishnu and they enter the universe by the arrangement of Brahma. This is not their birth, not their origin. All these entities, the living beings, including Brahma, and the Vedic sound, is eternal. Therefore, the Vedas are said to be aparusheya. They have no author. Impersonal is actually what aparusheya means. Impersonal in the sense that there's no author. Not even God is the author. Because there's not some time when God sat down and said, you know, we really need some books. We need some Vedas. No, they were there before. They always were there. So therefore, Krishna says in the Gita, Vedaischa Sarvair, Ahameva Vedya, Vedanta Krid Veda Vedeva Chaham. By all the Vedas, I am to be known. Although the Vedas seem to be talking about other people and other things, the real focus, the real message of the Vedas is the personality of God and his glories. The glories of the demigods are reflections of the glories of Govinda. And then he says, Krishna says in that same verse, Vedanta Krit, I'm the author of the Vedanta Sutra, because I incarnated as Vyas at the end of Dwarpa Yuga and wrote that Vedanta Sutra. But he doesn't say he's author of the Vedas. He says Veda Vid, and the knower of the Vedas. He doesn't claim authorship of the Vedas, you know, because the Vedas were never written down. They were never composed. They always existed. Even God doesn't think himself the author of the Vedas. That's the aparashaya status of the Vedic literature. So if you want to claim that something is Vedic, it should be based on that aparashaya authority. It shouldn't be a human creation, the figment of someone's fertile brain, creation of someone's own idea, but it's the eternal intelligence of the Supreme Lord himself that exists co-eternally with him, the plan of God, which is eternal. What manifests in the material world may be temporary. It has a beginning, Brahma, with the creation of Brahma, the creation of Mahatattva, then the birth of Brahma. Before that, that universe didn't exist, but that's just a particular manifestation of the material world. The plan, the basic plan, is eternal. It's just manifested and unmanifested at various times. That eternal plan of God for the spiritual and material worlds is recorded in the Vedic literature. The intelligence om etad mahabhutasya nishvasitam yad rigveda atharva veda, and so on. The Vedas and all their supplements constitute the breathing. This is coming from the breathing of Mahavishnu. And not just that, that's just a metaphorical presentation. They are the intelligence of God, or the recording of the intelligence of God. Just like a man writes a book, the heart and mind of the author are recorded in the book. You know, he may create various characters in his fiction, but the characters are actually creations of his own heart. They're actually reflections of himself. an author's characters are actually an aspect of his own personality. Like that, the Vedas are, everything that the Vedas say is a reflection of the mind and the heart of God. You want to know God? You want to know the Supreme? Then study the Vedas. You find the Vedas hard to understand? Then study Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam, Nigama Kalpa Taror Golitam Palam. The ripened essence of all the Vedic knowledge is presented in Srimad Bhagavatam. You want to know the Supreme Personality of Godhead? Fine. Srimad Bhagavatam will explain everything about Him. That's what it means to be Vedic. It's not a matter of superficialities or of being Indian or being anything else. Why do we consider certain Indian customs to be Vedic and we don't acknowledge that the customs in other civilizations are also Vedic? Why not the customs of the Siberian shamans? Why aren't they Vedic? Why do we consider them Mlecha, outcast? Because it's not based on this eternal knowledge. It's based on some human recreation, human limited understanding, not on the perfect understanding that comes originally from God. So it just happens that Vedic civilization, resided in India for most of the duration of human existence. It always was in India, and sometimes spread out to other places, but the center of it was always in India. Brahmavarta is the land where the Brahmanas live, where the great sages came. Rishivarta is a smaller section. Brahmavarta is a bigger section of India. It's central India, and we're living in it now, Brahmavarta, the place where Vedic sacrifices are performed, where the sages lived and their descendants, the great Brahmanas, lived, and Vedic culture was actually practiced on the earth. That's part of India, not all of India. The outskirts, Bengal, Andhra Pradesh, these places were barbaric before. But the original Vedic culture was situated in this area, from here to Punjab, down to maybe Jhansi. That's it. This is a land of higher human civilization. The fact that modern India is a complete mess and is not very attractive is something else. The original culture was here. It's now been completely distorted and almost completely lost. But it's still, this is the home of human civilization, and there are some traces of it left. That's what it means to be Vedic, to be following that, to be living that eternal human culture. It doesn't change, the essence of it doesn't change, but the practice, the external practices can be adjusted. The acharyas and sages in each age modify the external practices to fit the circumstances. So the Dharma Shastras, as opposed to the Vedanta Shastra and the Puranas, those are not fixed. The Dharma Shastras are rewritten in every age. There are different Dharma Shastras, practical law books of how people should behave, how they should dress, how they should eat, what they should do according to their stations in life. This is different in different ages. But it's for those who have the Vedic insight to judge that. No, it's not that there is no standard, anything goes. But standards are modified. The practices, external practices are modified, but the principles are eternal. How a human being can live intelligently and in a civilized fashion, that basic standard is fixed, doesn't change. Just the external application of it may change. In the beginning of creation, Brahma studied the Vedas 3 times to understand what is the real business of a living being. What he understood trillions of years ago is the same that Vyasadeva understood 5,000 years ago, the same that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught 500 years ago, the same that Prabhupada taught just a few years ago. The principles haven't changed. Therefore, Prabhupada is presenting the same text, Srimad Bhagavatam, even though it's very old. But it's not dated, it's not out of date, it's not irrelevant. So we should be conservative in that sense. We should try to live and preach the original human civilized culture. This is, if people want to be God conscious, they should live like this. They should live in a civilized fashion so they can understand the science of God. Externals may be adapted and changed, but the principles have to remain unchanged. Okay, so I'll stop. Are there any questions or comments?
We're talking about the Dharma Shastras. I had a question about Manu Samhita.
Yes.
A lot of times I hear different people fighting about this book. So a few questions is, one, I've heard devotees say that it's irrelevant because it was for another time or another age, and that because this is Kali Yuga that it's no longer applicable. And so that, and then they also say that there's no use in reading it because the Manu Samhita itself says that we're malechas and we can't even study it, so we're disqualified from even reading it. And then the third thing is, then if that's the case, should it ever be translated or presented for devotees?
Well, I wouldn't say that the Manu Samhita is altogether irrelevant, that it can't be put into practice. But putting into practice needs very intelligent adjustment. Just following the literal letter of what it stipulates will not work. It does have to be modified. It does have to be adapted to this modern times. And that takes very intelligent understanding. So, yes, it's not that anybody should pick it up and read, because they won't understand how to apply it. But it's not that nobody can read it. Now, those who can figure it out and apply it properly, they should. Prabhupada pointed out so many times that the Manu Samhita is a law book for mankind. Why did he say that if he didn't want us ever to look at it? You know, he doesn't want us to know how human beings should live. The details are not all there in Srimad Bhagavatam. Details of you know, how to do practical things. How to cook, how to eat, how to sleep, and you know, all these things. They're in the Dharma Shastras, in the Manu Smriti and others. But it's not for Shudras, it's for Brahmanas, it's for those who actually have the discrimination to judge how to apply. They're the ones who should study it and try to present it to others. Second question, what was that?
They say that that the Manu Samhita itself says that malechas can't study it, and so we're automatically disqualified from reading it, so there's no point
in it. Don't we have our principle that by initiation one becomes a Brahmin? So we're not malechas if we're initiated and following principles. Our background is malecha, but we're supposed to be transformed by following the sadhana, the bhakti sadhana process. And therefore we're fit. We can go and read the Rig Veda. We can go and perform a soma sacrifice if you really want to get into it. Yeah. So that argument doesn't stand. We're not malechas anymore. Unless we're, you know, not following the principles. And then third...
Should it be ever be translated for devotees?
It's already been translated. There are decent translations already. What still needs to be done is to figure out how to apply it to ISKCON. But that's not an easy job. That's not just a matter of translating the words. The words have already been translated, and the translations that are available are not bad. So we can just, if you want to see what it says...
Like Max Muller's?
Max Muller's too old. But there are other translations, more recent translations. Max Muller, he had an agenda. He wasn't part... He was too, European. But there are some other translations that are not bad. So you can read them. You can see what Manu Smita says, but how to apply it, that takes some judgment, a lot of judgment. That research has to be done. What can be done with the Manu Samhita that will be relevant to ISKCON?
what can be borrowed from it that will be of use, of practice. So books should be written about Manusamhita. Research should be done. A book should be written about it. And that can include translating it again, but first of all, we had to figure it out and how to apply it. Okay? All right. Anything else? Okay. Thank you all. Blurry Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.